session number 10905, rule 1.
Mr. Joggin, reel 1. Could you tell me when you joined the Navy and why you decided to join, please?
I joined the Royal Navy at HMS Ganges in 1937, and the reason that I joined, more than possible, was the fact that my father had been a time-serving sailor, and he gave me a lot of details about what life was like in the Navy. And I firmly believe that was the reason I joined. I had seen the Royal Hospital School being built from the little village where I lived, across the river, and that prompted me, really, my first thoughts about the Navy. Although, as I say, my father was a naval man, and he used to tell me all about his experiences. He'd done his 25 years, and he said what an asset it was to have a pension at the end of 25 years, and I'd be independent from, or certainly partly independent from jobs that I didn't want or did want. And that's about it.
Do you think he, with the benefit of hindsight, he gave you good advice?
I do, yes. I could have finished up as a farm labourer at Radnes. I mean, that was the only work that was in the village, and the majority of lads who were there worked on the farms, and I could have been the same.
Where were you trained?
For the Navy?
Yes.
Partly at Holbrook School, although that was more of a school than a naval training establishment, but you did learn certain basic things, drill and seamanship and things like that. But my whole my 9 months at Ganges from in 1937 was the training establishment where I learnt practically everything about the Navy.
Do you think it was a good training you had there?
Oh, brilliant, very, very good. It gave you everything. There was plenty of discipline. You hadn't got any time to mess around. You had it was pumped into your morning, noon and night about discipline and about training, about seamanship training, about a certain amount of gunnery training, and schooling. You went to school for the 9 months that you were there. On different days you had school days, and you had boat days on the river where you went down with the big 32-foot cutters, learning how to sail them, learning how to row them. We had a mast there, 360-odd-foot high, which you went over twice a week. You had to go over that as part of your drill first thing in the mornings. You had parade drill. You had to pass out on every aspect of your training. When you first arrived there, you were issued out with a full sailor's kit, which they stamped your name in, but you had to sew your name over in whatever, like red silk for your sailor's blue suit, and everything had to be sewn in, and that was all laid out as per seamanship manual, which showed you how the kit was to be laid out, and it was all done up with little pieces of string, and everything had to be in line, your name had to be in line, and it was all rolled. You had to have, that was the last thing that you'd done before you went to sea, that was a kit inspection, and that had to be absolutely spot on. Your boots had to be polished at the bottom, and they were turned up upside down and laid at the end of your kit. It was a brilliant seamanship training. It really showed you what the Navy required of you.
How were you treated by the people in charge?
Well, if you'd done as you were told, you had no problems. But if you'd done anything wrong, you got punished. You weren't allowed to smoke. If you got caught smoking whilst you were there, you had to see the commander, and you got so many days, what they call jankers, where you, part of your jank was running around the playground with a pole above your head. They called a janker pole, and that was for an hour every afternoon. And then after that, you had to get up early in the morning before the other boys, and we had to be out of bed at 6:30 anyway, but you had to get up at 6 o'clock and report to the playground, and you never got no sweet at dinner time. And I mean, it was really not worth smoking. But apart from that, you realise that what you come into, you've just got to keep your tongue between your teeth and do exactly as you were told. And I never ever got in trouble there because I'd done exactly that.
Did you feel you were treated fairly?
Oh, yes, very fairly. No, there's no problem about picking on boys or anything like that. Every boy was treated exactly the same because they were... in actual fact, they were too busy, really. The two instructors that we had were too busy to look for individual boys. They had a class of, we had 40 in our class, 40 boys, and every boy was, they were all treated the same. Some of them used to get a clip round the ear at times if they, you know, if they were doing anything silly. But I don't mean anything drastically silly, I mean just to show them that they got to keep up, because at the end of the 9 months, it was really how your instructors had taught you as to how good you were when you left, and that was reflected in your exam results, in the things that you'd done, your marching and your knowledge of seamanship, and as I say, your kit inspection, which was as I told you, one of the big things.
Did you think at that stage that a war was coming?
No. Had no idea. Possibly being 15 and a half years old, I don't really think that, personally, I didn't enter my head.
Would it have made any difference to your wanting to join the Navy if you had thought of what was coming?
I don't know. I've never ever given it a thought, not in that respect. I just know that I wanted to join the Navy, and that was it, you know. I mean, I suppose... If I'd have been older and gave it a bit more thought, I might have thought twice, I suppose, about getting involved. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because I would have been called up. And being trained for it was better than being hoiked into the Navy and just, you know, fending for yourself, more or less.
Did you become a seaman, or did you become a specialist?
No, I became a seaman, and then from there you specialise in gunnery. I specialise in gunnery.
Was that because you wanted to?
Well, there wasn't a lot of outlet, really. I mean, it was either gunnery, or, as you see, that chap was a diver. I mean, you could have specialised in that, but I didn't fancy putting a diving suit on because they were a totally different kettle of fish to what they are these days. The other thing that you could have been, a telegraphist, you know, in the communications branch, but you had to be at Shotley for 18 months to be a specialist, to join that sort of thing, and that never ever appealed to me, really, not that side of the Navy. I mean, I wanted to be a seaman first and foremost, I suppose.
Where were you and what were you doing when the announcement that we were at war with Germany came?
I was on the Resolution. I was in Portland Harbour, and I heard the announcement of the outbreak of war outside the midshipman's mess on the Resolution at 11 o'clock on that Sunday morning in Portland Harbour.
How did everybody react when they heard it?
Oh, I think really with as far as I was concerned and a lot of our other young lads, I mean, this had been a boys' training ship, the Resolution, and then when the crisis came in 1938, we left Scapa Flow and came to Sheerness, and the ship decommissioned buoys. They left a few of us on there, and they brought seamen and reserves onto the ship, you know, in preparation, I suppose, for the what was to become inevitable. It was going to be some trouble in the future, and they turned it over from a boys' transship back to a normal battleship. And you done your next year war training, I suppose you could say. But I think the majority of the lads that who I knew personally as boys on the ship, you know, under 18, I think their idea was sometimes it was a bit of a joke, you know. I don't think they really believed that that they were going to be at war. And it wasn't until the first siren went on the Monday morning after war broke out on the 4th of September that they had an air raid warning siren, and everybody was on the mess deck. It was always remembered, it was 8 o'clock in the morning, and everybody was on the mess deck, and they were looking around, and on the walls of the mess deck was a siren, and it showed you on there what the different blasts on the siren meant. And we all looked at this thing, and we could see that, I don't know whether it was a short and three long blasts or what it was, but they said, Christ, that's an air raid warning. And everybody rushed up top, and we all went to our different positions where we were supposed to go, where we'd been trained to go. And my position was what they called the ADP, that was the air defence platform, halfway up the foremast on the ship, where you sat there with a pair of binoculars. There was four chaps sat there with on a seat with binoculars, which were fixed to the side of the ship, you know, and you had to look for enemy aircraft. And that was when I began to get a bit scared and thinking, well, I don't know, this is not a joke anymore, you know. But nothing happened. We never saw no planes, and after about an hour or so, the all clear went. And people said, I wonder if that was right or whether that was an exercise or what it was. But we never ever found out. But we certainly never saw no planes that day.
Can you tell me what living on Resolution was like in the war? Can you give a picture of what life on a battleship in the Second World War was like?
Yeah. We had mess decks. And in the mess decks you'd have about an average. On my mess deck we had six messes, the six mess tables, and there was 20 blokes in each mess. So you're talking about what, 120 men on that one mess deck, which wasn't very big. And then on the gangways of the mess deck you'd have your lockers where your clothes were kept. And it was, all in all, it was really, especially at sea, it was really muggy and hot. And it didn't smell very nice. In fact, you felt claustrophobic, because you had, each mess deck was a compartment where you had watertight doors at either end, so that if anything happened, those watertight, whether you were in there or not, those watertight doors had to be closed, and your exit from your mess deck was up a ladder in the middle of the mess deck, which also had a watertight door, which had to be clamped down if the ship got hit. And in actual fact, when you were in action, those watertight doors were always closed. Not that we were ever on the mess deck, because you were at your gunnery station or torpedo station or wherever you were supposed to be. But that was claustrophobic, and as the war progressed, the ship that the Resolution, she didn't make enough water for an abundance of baths and washing your clothes and things, so water was rationed. You were rationed to 1 gallon of water per day per man to do everything in. That was to drink, to clean your teeth, to wash, to do your washing, to make tea for your mess. It was a water rationing thing, where at the top of our mess deck we had 20 buckets with a gallon of water in each, which you all had your name painted. We used to paint our names on the side of the bucket so they knew who was what. But after a while, you got round to the position of saying, well, us four will wash, we'll chip our water in, we'll wash with one lot, we'll clean the teeth with one lot and do the washing, and the other lot will make the tea. So it was a communal effort, so that you each had enough water for your needs of that day. And then the next day you went lined up, there was a long queue, you lined up and you got your next gallon of water for the next day. And the food was rubbish because you couldn't get any good food. In fact, potatoes and things like that were, I remember one place we went to, they shipped tons and tons of sweet potatoes on the ship, and they finished by throwing them over the side because nobody would eat them. And then we used to get this mash stuff, you know, in tins. We made bread, the cooks on the ship made bread, but if we had a destroyer escort with us, which we did most of the time if we were convoying and things like that, the bread was sent over to the destroyers because they were living on hardtack, they were living on biscuits most of the time. And if we had bread, that used to go to the destroyers because they had it rough. The only good thing about living on being on the Rezzo was she was a big ship, I suppose, and the comradeship was pretty good. But the living, I wouldn't recommend that for it to anybody. I mean, it was hard going, really. But then when you got back to harbour, like I said before, you look forward to your run ashore and forget all about the crossings, because we crossed the Atlantic 3 times in the first 3 months of the war, taking gold to Halifax in Canada and bringing back convoys. The first convoy we brought back was 96 merchant ships, and we had a destroyer escort for about the first day and a half out of Halifax, and then we were met a day and a half out by a destroyer escort from Britain. We used to take these convoys into Scotland and then go down to Portland and pick up our next batch of gold. They were gold bars. The second convoy, we brought the first Canadian troops over. We had 5 large liners that we brought over, and we'd done that trip in a week, although the other times it took us 21 days to bring the other two convoys that we had. We had to bring them back 21 days because the speed of the convoy was determined by the slower ship.
What were the Canadian troops like?
We brought them back in convoys, so we didn't. The thing that stuck out in my mind was when we got into Scotland. We ushered the ships in first. We were met by the tribal class destroyers about a day and a half out. They escorted us in. We lost one of the ships, but they found that it was foggy, and we lost one of these big liners. And she was found by one of our escorts and joined up with the convoy again. And we were the last ones in. And I always remember that they tied these ships up in the stream, and all these Canadian troops were up on deck and were giving us 3 cheers when we come in. I mean, as the escort, I suppose. But one ship, the Aquitania, was full of Canadian nurses. She had all nurses on there. There was the Aquitania, the Monarch of Bermuda was another one, Empress of Australia, and there was 2 more, but the names are gone for a moment.
How did you get on? How did the ratings get on with the petty officers on board the Resolution?
Much the same as they did at Shotley, at Ganges. You had to do as you were told, and you still treat them with a great deal of respect because they were time serving men. You know, they'd done their time in the Navy. You had your funny ones amongst them, you know, people who were really nasty people, you know, who you had to jump at every word of command. But then you had, as the war progressed further, you had the things got more comradely amongst the lads and the petty officers, and the chief petty officers, of course. I think the feeling being that they realised that we were all in this together, and everybody had to pull together, and that was that.
What about the officers? What did you think about the officers on board the Resolution?
Oh, they were all right. The worst officers that I found in the Navy, funnily enough, were people who were promoted from the lower deck. Possibly again, knowing everything that was going on, and they knew the answers, and they were the worst ones to get tangled with. The other ones were university people and talked nicely, and they were quite all right. There was no problem with them at all. We only had a couple of officers who were actually ex lower deck people.
One was my
divisional officer, actually, a man called Wright. He wasn't too bad, but he knew the answers, you know. Before you ever went to him with a problem, he got the answer. So they were the officers that I liked were the ones who, I'm not saying he didn't know anything, obviously they wouldn't have been in that position, but they were people who I think were more humane than the other ones, if I can say that word, really, because they knew really what was, you know, I don't know whether they thought they were better than us or what, but they didn't show it, you know. I mean, there was none of that business. Whereas I think the people who came from the lower deck were, I've got this far, you know, and that's it.
What about this business of drinking rum in the Navy? Do you think that was a good system or not? Because the American Navy doesn't have it.
No, they're dry, aren't they? So is our Navy now, isn't it? We don't have rum. Well, with a lot of people, it got to be a ritual. 11 o'clock. They couldn't wait for 11 o'clock to come, you know, so they'd go and get their tot. I mean, chiefs and petty officers were allowed to have their rum neat. But the troops, I say the troops, that was the leading seaman down. And then you had to be 20 before you could draw your rum. That was watered. That was watered down to 3-1. You had three tots of water to one tot of rum. But it was amongst the older personnel, the older three beds old boys, you know, it was a ritual with them. They couldn't do without their 11 o'clock tot. The troops never got theirs at 11. The petty officers and chief petty officers did, but the lads used to get theirs at 12 o'clock for some reason or other. But at 12 o'clock you'd see we had an old fella in our mess who religiously lined up to get the rum every day from the where they were serving at 8, and he would come down and serve at 8 in the cups at the top of the table. How many tots were, if you had 15 blokes in the mess drawing, as they called it, he'd put out 15 tots, and he was an expert at making sure everybody got the same amount, you know. And then he'd stand at the top of the table, and it was always, you know, God bless the Queen and or the King or where it was, and he'd drink his tot then and lick his lips, and that was with him was a ritual every day. He wouldn't miss his tot, and I wouldn't be surprised if a man like that, when he come out the Navy, wouldn't have a tot of rum every day at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. But with us, the first tot I ever had, it made me feel sick because it was pretty strong, you know. But it wasn't a be all and end all as far as I was concerned.
But do you think it was useful when you went into action?
Well, it certainly steadied you down. I'll say that for it. I mean, it certainly made you feel better than you would have done if you hadn't had a tot. But then you only got it at 12 o'clock, and if they started throwing things at you, you soon sobered up, you know. But it was, I don't think the chaps looked for it in that sense. I think it was the fact that it was a ritual more than anything. It was a ritual for their 11 o'clock touch or 12 o'clock touch, whatever it was. And, you know, that I think that was the be all and end all. I wasn't really for it or against it. You know, I mean, I just drank it because it was there. If you didn't draw it, you got threepence a day. You were given three pet threepence, you know, the old three threepence a day for your tot, if you didn't draw your tot.
Were people proud to be in the Royal Navy?
Oh, I think so. The regular service people. I never ever, in all my time of 16 years that I'd done, I never ever heard anybody running it down until the latter end of my time. You know, when I was finished up then as a petty officer down at Shotley.
That was about 53, was it?
That was 53 time. I think it was getting to the point where a lot of people, especially the older staff, could see the beginning of the end of the old Navy. In other words, it was the beginning of the end of good discipline, because you weren't allowed to shout at a boy when I was there at the finish. I mean, if you did, the local MP from his area would be writing to the captain, and you got hauled up in front of the captain and want to know why you shouted at this boy. And it was getting so you didn't instill the discipline that you'd had when I was a boy. And I think a lot of the chaps who said, well, the favourite saying was roll on my 12, because we all had to sign for 12 years when I was a boy. And the old saying was coming out then about roll on my 12. You know, they wanted to finish their time and get out. But all the time, I mean, during the war and things like that, I never heard anybody run it down. In fact, the majority of chaps that I knew loved the life. And I think the only time when it got a little bit dodgy during the war was if they came home and got married and then found out that they got to leave their wives behind. That was some of it. As I got married in 1943, and I didn't particularly fancy going away and leaving my wife, you know. But you'd sign and you had to do your time anyway. You couldn't come out because the war was still on. But no, I never had anybody run it down. I think by and large that was a real good. It was a real good job, and the only thing about it was the money wasn't any good. The money was very poor, not like it is today, but times change, don't they?
Let's come on to Norway now, and can you tell me how you went to Norway in the first place in 1940?
Well, we'd came home from our last trip to Canada. The last convoy was in about January of 1940, and we'd been told, a naval rumour is a buzz. Anybody, have you heard the latest buzz? We were told that our job for the duration of the war would be going to Canada with gold. I don't know where they were going to get all this gold from, because we'd been there three times and we'd had to take out 6-inch shells out of our magazine to put the gold in. And there was another ship also doing the same trip. I think it was the Royal Sovereign. And they told us that would be our